This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. On this week's episode, we're bringing you one of the panel sessions from our annual SMH Year in Review event. This one features economics editor Ross Gittins, political and international editor Peter Harcher, and chief political correspondent David Crow. This discussion was recorded in front of a live audience of our subscribers in Sydney on November 20. Right at this moment, as we are here, over in the ballroom at the Fullerton Hotel in the old GPO, there are hundreds of people who sadly missed out on tickets to tonight's sold-out event, SMH, and are consoling themselves by attending the annual Business Council of Australia dinner. Where any minute now, after the mains are served, the Prime Minister will be making a speech. And in that speech, as David Crow reported in today's Sydney Morning Herald, he will say, "A responsible and sensible government doesn't run the country as if it is constantly at DEFCON 1, whether on the economy or any other issue." Peter Harcher, does this mean we should all just have a gin and tonic and relax?
Well, you don't even want to be at DEFCON 1, you know, defence readiness condition, highest alert, if you actually had a problem. So Sydney yesterday, worst air quality city in the world, wreathed in fires that the RFS says are unprecedented. Bushfire season started in winter. The Sydney water catchment is at 46%, and even with the desal plant pumping, it's, according to Sydney Water, falling faster than it has in decades. According to panic merchants like NASA, the insurance industry, the Reserve Bank, and the Australian Defence Force, climate change poses a real and growing threat to our security, our economy, our society, our agriculture. All I can say is it's just as well climate change isn't real, otherwise we might have a real problem. So yeah, why be at DEFCON 1 when you could just relax?
Yep. So it has been an enormous year, and we have spent a lot of time in print and on panels and on the podcast going over how it was that Scott Morrison actually attained the leadership and won the election. So I don't think we should go too far back in the past because we have to get through the situation at the moment. But David, you wrote a book that came out earlier this year called Venom, which was about the last 5 years of the Liberal Party and the battle that went on in there. Is there still scars in the federal Liberal Party that are yet to heal despite Scott Morrison's miraculous election victory?
Yeah, I think there are. I think that he clearly won the election in a way that gave him immense authority within his party and his government. And he has this sort of steady-as-she-goes kind of approach, which is very slow at the moment in terms of defining what he stands for and what big issues he wants to fight for. But that's partly because he's got this still difficult party room where there are still some of those old hatreds still around. And I think Peter Dutton, for instance, failed in his bid to become Prime Minister last year, and I thought may never have that opportunity again. But it's interesting when you talk to Liberal MPs who say, look, don't count that out. When they see Peter Dutton positioning himself as sort of harder on China compared to Scott Morrison, well, is that leadership positioning as well? Now, that choice may never come again, right? But it's interesting that within the Liberal Party room, they see these things and they watch and they monitor what's happening. In the same way that you see two up-and-comers, Josh Frydenberg as the deputy and Christian Porter as the Attorney General, who's also the leader in the lower house, who's also the Industrial Relations Minister with a lot of responsibility and a lot of scope. Well, these are the two people who could be future leadership contenders. And so I think there is always that question in that party room.
Ross, we may not be at DEFCON 1, that is debatable, but there are certainly many challenges facing the Morrison government, not least the economy. Are we headed for a recession?
I don't think we necessarily are, no. I think the economy has slowed down very sharply in the past 12 months, and we're going to get some figures in 2 weeks' time for the September quarter. They may show that the economy is much stronger than we thought, or it may yet be a fifth quarter of weak growth. So what that's saying is the economy is just grinding along in second gear. It's not saying that we're about to go into a recession. One of the reasons why a recession is unlikely without external intervention is that a lot of the growth is just coming from the increased immigration and strong population growth. About two-thirds of the growth we've achieved has been achieved just because we've been adding to the population. We've been making the economy bigger by having more people. You're mainly meant to make the economy bigger by having more efficiency and more productivity and more participation in the workforce, but we're getting it just by having a lot of population growth. But what that means is we're not actually making much progress. There is measures of people's living standards haven't improved for some years, but we've got all these people coming, and you have to get rid of all those before you start getting down into having a minus sign.
When you say get rid of them, you mean that figuratively.
Well, no, you've got to slow it all down. And it may of itself slow down when people in overseas countries see that our economy is very weak, they'll be less inclined to want to move here.
Well, Morrison says he's slowing it down in the permanent intake, but meanwhile, the temporary intake is still up.
He's playing games because he, like every politician, Liberal or Labor, believes in a big Australia, but their market researchers have told them that that's not a good thing to say, and so they think of these ways of making it sound like they're slowing it all down. But the thing that could push us into recession is some kind of adverse shock coming to us from the rest of the world. And you have to say, A, we're so close to bumping along the bottom that we're vulnerable to that, and more vulnerable than we were back in 2008 in the
GFC.
See, I get confused between GST and GFC.
He's only the economics editor, it's fine.
But the other thing is that you have to say that it's quite possible that the world economy might slow down more than it has. It's not growing very strongly either. So I'm not predicting a recession, but I'm saying the probability of that might be small, but it's higher than it normally is.
So I'd like to get the thoughts of all of you on how well equipped our current government leadership is to deal with the potential of an oncoming recession. Peter, you interviewed RBA Governor Philip Lowe in early September, I think it was, and you wrote in your piece in The Good Weekend about all of the global factors that were impacting on us at the moment. And you said, Lowe would like some help navigating through this brave new world from Frydenberg and PM Scott Morrison. An epic clash could be looming, testing the credibility of the powers of the Morrison government on the one hand and those of Lowe's RBA on the other. That sounds terribly exciting, this epic, epic clash.
Well, look, when you're writing about a central banker, you do what you can to make it interesting, right?
But what does Philip Lowe want Josh Frydenberg to do?
Ross, you might have a longer memory than me on this, but I can't remember a more open split between a Prime Minister and the Reserve Bank on economic policy, where for a couple of years now, but with increasing stridency and regularity, Phil Lowe, the governor of the Reserve Bank, keeps imploring, really, if you decode the language, he's really imploring the federal government to act on the basis that with the official interest rate below one percentage point now, you know, the monetary accelerator is pretty much flat to the floor, and he's turning to the fiscal and structural side of the game, which is operated out of Canberra, not out of Martin Place, and saying, please, guys, it's time. And he doesn't think that they're acting with sufficient speed and seriousness. And on the other hand, we don't see much sign from Morrison and Frydenberg that they intend to do anything other than, I mean, you know, they are tinkering. And David Crowe has been telling us that, you know, in this morning's paper, what Scott was going to announce next. And we're having a national productivity agenda, one pork barrel road announcement at a time, apparently.
Yeah.
That's not what the Reserve Bank has in mind. Phil Lowe has something a little more sweeping and fundamental in mind.
David, can a government that has pegged its pitch to voters so heavily on bringing the budget back to surplus turn around now and say, actually, stimulus is more important than us achieving our promise of delivering a surplus?
No, I think they've locked themselves in a position where they have to deliver the budget surplus, and that is absolutely what they're about. Today, for instance, Scott Morrison talked about $3.8 billion in bringing forward infrastructure spending around the country. Tomorrow, we'll have it in the paper that there'll be some funding for some New South Wales infrastructure, but we're talking about $3.8 billion over 4 years in an economy that's got a GDP of $1.8 trillion. So in terms of the growth dividend from what he's talking about, it's really just a rhetorical flourish, and that's because they do not want to go anywhere at the moment where they talk about actually spending big, big money that puts that surplus at risk.
What about bringing the tax cuts forward?
It depends on what calculation Scott Morrison makes, which is, am I likely to lose the next election because I didn't deliver on a budget surplus, which a lot of economists have said, stop worrying about, it's not that important, not in our present circumstances. Or could it be that if, under my watch, I allowed the economy to really almost grind to a halt with rising unemployment, with wages stuck at 2% growth a year, is it possible that the electorate could get so angry at our mismanagement of the economy that they might actually throw us out? You see, what I don't understand about these guys is that they think there's politics over there and there's economics over there. And that's the box that matters. The other box, you know, why are people panicking? Well, if they had any sense, and this is what gets me about these guys, they don't understand that politics ends up being, have you stuffed the economy or not? It doesn't end up being, did you keep your promise to create a budget surplus?
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this message.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor, vessel, Pong, Sue, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator, and mateship.
Flag of my honour is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue on your favourite podcast app.
Peter, when you were doing your reporting during the election campaign, what did you get a sense? I know you went to some focus groups and you talked to a lot of people. What did you get a sense about what people really wanted?
Well, people didn't know what Labor was offering on their positive agenda. Nobody seemed to have any idea what the positive Labor offerings were, but they all knew what the Labor risks were. So that made them retreat into the security of the known, of the status quo. If you're looking at an alternative government that's offering a fairly unknown and therefore risky policy set, where you're being told by the government every day that they're going to wreck everything, and you don't think the status quo is too terrible, you retreat into the status quo. And, you know, at the outset, I was very sort of snide about Morrison, and, you know, I wrote a column saying he has to decide whether he wants to be the Prime Minister or the Prime Minimal, because of the minimalism of his agenda so far. He won on a very minimalist election platform where he said, it's the tax cuts, I'll give you tax cuts and the status quo, and that's it, folks.
What he said was, the economy is very strong, and all I've got left to do is to deliver some big tax cuts.
Yep.
That's the proposition
that
he sold. And notwithstanding the big tax cuts, we'll have a big surplus too. Now, not one leg of that is looking all that wonderful right now.
David, where does this leave Labor? Have they even begun to rebuild their agenda?
They have begun. It's interesting that when they did their election review, the people doing that review deliberately avoided any conclusions about policies, franking credits, negative gearing and so forth. And so that debate is still to be had. And all that Anthony Albanese has done is really map out how they're going to resolve that without taking a hard decision on these things. So I think that could take all of next year, because there'll be an ALP conference at the end of 2020 where they'll make some big decisions about policy direction. Franking credits are still there as a policy item for them, so is negative gearing. There are some in the caucus who believe that they'll stick with negative gearing because it gives them a promise to younger people who feel shut out of the housing market. And they did take it to the 2016 election, and it, you know, they feel that it's been tested and they can stand by it. Franking credits is a really big question because they could cap it, they could dump it. They all acknowledge that what cost them badly was the sheer scale of their agenda.
Yep.
So that means they're not blaming any one of these items.
And it certainly wasn't franking credits.
Well, something would have to go. So they have to scale back the size of the agenda.
But they weren't the real problem.
Well, what do you think the real problem was?
The real problem was that they were doing too much. They were moving this, they were changing that. They couldn't explain that to anyone. They didn't have any slick three-word slogans to explain it all. And they left some people, apparently, with the idea that the Labor Party doesn't believe in economic growth, doesn't care about jobs.
Well, and overarching all of that, of course, was Bill Shorten. So they're already starting well ahead because they've got rid of Bill Shorten. I remember sitting in Melbourne in a focus group behind the glass, eight non-committed voters talking about how they felt about the different leaders. And the convener said, OK, now I want you to give me first things that come to mind when I mention the name of Bill Shorten. There's a brief silence. They're all looking contemplatively at the ceiling. And one bloke leans forward and he says, I'd like to punch him in the head. And you knew that Shorten was in trouble when nobody dissented. And the bloke sitting next to him went, yeah, yeah.
Do you think, Peter, that the ALP will give Anthony Albanese long enough to have a proper policy rebuild before they start panicking and knife him?
Look, well, this is one of the big questions about where Australian politics is at, isn't it? Have we emerged from the revolving door phase, that restless, pointless ambition, ambitiousness of everybody to have their turn as Prime Minister? Both major parties have changed their internal rules. Notionally, this is to prevent a sudden coup to make it more difficult to change leader mid-term. And notionally, in the case of Labor, it's supposed to be practically impossible. Now, that's important in itself, just the fact that they've changed the rules because it means that they've recognised there's a problem. But the rules themselves don't guarantee stability because if you have the numbers to roll the Prime Minister or the opposition leader, then you have the numbers to change the rules. So you could change the rules and then roll him anyway. So it's still ultimately the only protection against reverting into that mad phase of, you know, constant regicide and bloodshed everywhere, with everything else subsumed and forgotten, is the maturity and restraint of our political class.
Ah, well, we'd be right then.
Yes, that's what it says. We'll be right.
Very, very quickly. No, I'm very sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off because we are on a strict schedule. A to E, the current federal government, how are they performing? Give them a rank. David.
Oh, look, it'd have to be C. Like, they're performing in the middle of the range. They're a work in progress. They're still figuring out what they really want to fight for, what they really want really stand for. They get a bit of it. Maybe it's a C plus because they haven't rolled their leader yet, right?
So no there's spills, a bit of you get
there's
a
bit of stability there. But
that's Peter,
I'd prefer to put a P in front, like a P plate, because it's only half a year and anything could happen. But based on sheer performance against promise. Yeah, I'd give them a C as well. It's very early.
You get the last word, Ross.
I'd give them a D.
There's a shock.
Sorry. I mean, I've just been amazed at how little they've done, how little they seem to want to do.
All right.
They got their tax cuts through in the first 10 minutes and now they're sort of doing another lap of honour.
Okay. Please thank Peter, Ross and David.
Thank you so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Ross Gittins, Peter Harcher and David Crowe. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, so to support independent journalism, search Subscribe, the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Join us next week for the first episode of our summer series on climate change and weather with Environment Editor Peter Hannam. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. It was recorded at the SMH Live event at the International Convention Centre in front of a live audience on November 20. Technical assistance by Yuji Shimada. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.